You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Up next, how much do you know about women's health, about the differences in disease rates between men and women, for example? There are some diseases, did you know, that disproportionately affect women. Women are more likely to get autoimmune diseases like lupus and multiple sclerosis. And then there's AIDS. Worldwide, women now account for nearly half of the 40 million people with HIV, nearly 60% in sub-Saharan Africa. In this country, AIDS is the leading killer of African-American women aged 25 to 34. And if I asked you to name the biggest disease killer of women, what would you say? Breast cancer? Mm-mm. You'd be wrong. Heart disease. Heart disease is the number one killer of women, and it kills more women than men each year. But unlike men, women get heart disease later in life, usually after menopause. Well, this hour we're going to talk about the sex differences in disease, what scientists are learning about their biology and genetic underpinnings, and how they matter in disease prevention, diagnosis, and treatment. For example, should there be clinical trials that separate men from women to see how they respond differently to drugs? Grouping everybody into one study. Should they separate men and women? We'll talk about it. These are some of the questions we're going to be trying to answer this hour, and welcome your questions if you'd like to join our discussion. Our number is 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK. As always, you can surf over to our website at sciencefriday.com for more information. On to my guest. Sherry Martz is the Vice President for Scientific Affairs at the Society for Women's Health Research in Washington. She joins us today from our NPR studios there. Welcome back to the program, Dr. Martz.
Thank you very much. I'm happy to be here.
Thank you. Dr. Richard Karas is the co-director of the Molecular Cardiology Research Center, the director of preventive cardiology, and the director of the Women's Health Center at Tufts New England Medical Center. He's also associate professor of medicine at Tufts University School of Medicine, and he's in our studios at WBUR in Boston. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, it's a pleasure to be here.
Thank you. Judy Auerbach is the Vice President for Public Policy and Program Development at the American Foundation for AIDS Research, AMFAR, in Washington. Excuse me. She joins us today from AMFAR's New York office. Welcome to the program, Dr. Auerbach.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
You're welcome. Dr. Smarts, give us a quick overview. What are major health issues for women? You know, that was an interesting statistic I read about women dying more of heart disease than men do.
Absolutely, and your listeners are now a little bit better informed than many physicians in the United States. There was a study that came out earlier this year that found that one in five physicians interviewed didn't know that cardiovascular disease was the leading killer of women, and of course that has implications for care, particularly for preventive care, mm-hmm. for women who are at risk of the disease. So cardiovascular disease is the leading killer of women. The leading cause of death is going to vary, obviously, over the lifespan and according to ethnic group and socioeconomic status and that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. Certainly cardiovascular disease is something we should all be worried about. In terms of cancer, you know, women are afraid of breast cancer because they've heard so much about it, and that's to the credit of the breast cancer organizations. However, lung cancer has surpassed breast cancer as leading cancer killer of women in this country.
Smoking?
And again, absolutely. Smoking is a factor in both cardiovascular disease and lung cancer. Smoking has a disproportionate health impact on women, even if you control for the amount of smoke that women are exposed to by body weight and years smoked and number of cigarettes smoked. Women are disproportionately affected. They're more likely to get lung cancer. They're more likely to develop chronic obstructive pulmonary diseases like emphysema or chronic mm-hmm. bronchitis. So one of the best things a woman can do for her health is to not smoke, either don't start, or if you do smoke, quit.
Mm-hmm. I was interested in the statistics even in this country on HIV/AIDS being the fifth leading killer of women?
Absolutely. It's something that's, you know, it gets referred to as the feminization of the AIDS epidemic.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Auerbach, we keep hearing about this epidemic going on in Africa.
Well, right. It's actually going on all over the world. And what's particularly drawn our attention recently is the disproportionate impact that HIV and AIDS is having on women and girls around the world. That includes the United States.
Mm-hmm. Any part of the country or in the United States or all over?
No, it's widespread across the country, but there are different cities and different racial and ethnic populations or groups by poverty. And some of the same conditions and distinctions that Sherry mentioned are true for all health issues would apply to HIV and AIDS as well, that some mm-hmm. populations of women and girls are more vulnerable than others.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Karas, I mentioned and we talked a little bit about more women than men dying each year from heart disease. Why is that?
Well, as you mentioned in the opening, the women tend to get heart disease about 10 years later than do men. And so in part as a result of the fact that the women tend to live longer than men, there are more older women out there, and that really drives some of the high rates of heart disease in women. Mm-hmm. As women age, their risk of having heart disease goes up very steeply.
That's interesting. Does it affect women differently, I mean, internally?
Yeah, in terms of the problems that develop in the blood vessels that lead to such things as heart attacks, there are differences in that whole process between the blood vessels in women and the blood vessels in men.
Tell us about that.
Well, what causes a heart attack is that typically in men is that atherosclerotic plaque or a lesion in the artery cracks, and that causes the blood to clot on that injured artery and block the artery off so that there's not sufficient blood flow to the rest of the heart. In the women, that tends to more wear away at the plaque than for the plaque to abruptly rupture.
That's interesting. I don't think any of us ever realized that before. Do they have the same kind of symptoms when they're getting a heart attack, women do, as men do?
There are some differences. There's also a lot of overlap. But the part of the problem in this whole area is that so much of what people commonly think about heart disease was really derived from studying men. So the idea of the kind of crushing chest pain, maybe radiating down the left arm, et cetera, that's really much more typical in men. Mm-hmm. In women, the signs that a woman is having a heart attack can actually be quite subtle,
right.
And can really just be some difficulty catching her breath, feeling a bit sick to her stomach, a bit nauseous, that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And those more subtle signs are much more common in women than they are in men.
Now, there are a lot of people, as they get older, develop diabetes. Do women develop diabetes and have different symptoms and causes than men do?
The development of diabetes itself is relatively similar, though women more commonly have diabetes than do men. Mm-hmm. And more importantly for this discussion, the impact of developing diabetes on heart disease risk is considerably higher in women than it is in men.
They're at a greater risk.
They become at an even greater risk when they develop diabetes. So for any given aged individual, because of this shift to older individuals in women, if for a man and a woman of the same age, the woman typically has a lower risk of heart disease mm-hmm. than the man. Mm-hmm. If she develops diabetes, that basically takes away that protection of being a woman, and her rate of heart disease becomes equivalent of a man of about the same age.
Interesting. We're seeing an epidemic of diabetes in youngsters and teenagers and people who never, you know, type 2 diabetes. Are women developing at the same rate that boys and men are?
Yes, and that is really two comments. That is really a very important concern for the future, because there's a lot of information that suggests that youngsters who are overweight turn into adults who are overweight. And mm-hmm. that is the leading cause of diabetes in this country. Mm-hmm. And secondly, we commented about the rates of heart disease in men and women. Sad to say that though the rates of heart disease death have been declining in men over the last several years, that same success has not been found in women.
Why is that?
Well, they're potentially, you know, that's a little difficult to sort out, whether it's being driven by increasing epidemics in obesity and diabetes, that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. It is clearly impacted by the lower rates of aggressive treatment in women. Women don't consider themselves to be at risk for heart disease, so they don't tend to be as interested in the preventive measures that they could be and should be. So it's a whole, I think it's a whole variety of factors that impacts on it. But it really underscores the need for redoubling our efforts at, you know, prevention of heart disease and treatment of heart disease in women specifically.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Martz, let's talk about chronic diseases and illnesses. We're talking, I was mentioning a bit in the open that chronic diseases affect men and women differently.
Absolutely. And the example that you gave of the autoimmune diseases is probably the most egregious. There are about 80 diseases that have been categorized as having an autoimmune component or of some kind. And what that means is that the immune system in the body, the system that generally fights off infection, turns on some part of the body and starts to attack it. So in the case of rheumatoid arthritis, it happens in the joints. In the case of type 1 diabetes, it happens in the pancreas, et cetera. In multiple sclerosis, it's in the central nervous system. And all of these diseases, with the exception of one or two fairly rare autoimmune diseases, occur more often in women than men. It's not really clear why. We know that there are significant sex differences in the immune system and how the immune cells react to being exposed to an antigen, to an invader. But why women are more at risk of developing a disease as a result of that, we don't really understand.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Auerbach, you talked about the disproportionate occurrence of HIV/AIDS in women. You call this the feminization of AIDS. Can you tell us why this is happening?
Well, right. It's a very interesting question, and I think to relate it to the earlier comments, what we have to look at in all these disease areas is the interplay between sex as some sort of biological category based on hormones and genes and chromosomes, and the interaction between biologic sex and what more generally we can think of as cultural and social issues around gender and how that operates as a social organizing principle in most societies that do affect these differences between women and men's experiences of disease. In the case of HIV and AIDS, this disproportionality, as I say, is what is causing us to start talking about the feminization of AIDS, because women have had HIV and AIDS since the beginning of the epidemic, but it's just the proportional increase relative to men and boys that is really quite startling over the years. And if you look at this with this combination of biological, social, cultural, and environmental factors at the same time, you see how they operate simultaneously and interactively in virtually all aspects of HIV and AIDS. So from transmission and acquisition through disease progression, response to treatment, access to prevention and care services, and even, you know, dissemination or access to information, as was mentioned earlier. So just to give a couple of examples, male-to-female HIV transmission is more efficient. So women are anywhere from 2 to 8 times more likely to acquire HIV from men during an act of sexual intercourse than the other way around. So women are more biologically vulnerable to transmission and acquisition. This is actually heightened for young women or adolescent girls it has to do with the physiology of the female genital tract, and that vulnerability is greater in younger women or girls whose cervix and other parts of the reproductive tract are not yet as developed and, as I say, more vulnerable to infection. Mm-hmm. Women also, under similar processes, are more susceptible to certain other sexually transmitted infections, and we know from research that the presence of those other sexually transmitted infections, which are often asymptomatic, and again more easily transmitted from males to females than the other way around, can increase vulnerability to HIV infection as well. When you look at once a woman is infected compared to men, we find that HIV infection exhibits much greater viral diversity in women than men at the time of infection. Women have lower what we call viral loads, the amount of HIV RNA, than do men, about 30 to 50% lower at the same CD4 cell count. So there's another difference. And when the disease manifests, it can manifest differently in women and men. So there are some very sex-specific differences. So, for example, women are more likely to have cervical cancer, obviously, and men are more likely to have Kaposi sarcoma or a certain kind of pneumonia. Mm-hmm. There are some differences in drug toxicities and side effects despite similar responses to therapy. So there's all these ways in which biologically and clinically you can see these differences. But all of that is taking place in a context in most societies where women and men do not have equal status. And the difference in their social status is a great part of the explanation for why the rates are going up in women and has a lot to do with how the epidemic is transmitted and how we respond to it.
We're talking about the women's health issues this hour on Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. Our number, 1-800-989-8255, is our number. If you'd like to call and ask questions about, questions about women's health. Dr. Karas, where does estrogen fit into heart disease? Does it explain why women get heart disease later than men?
Well, actually, that's an excellent question following on the discussion that we were just having, because as with HIV/AIDS, what determines an individual's risk of heart disease is also a mixture of the very same factors, biological factors, cultural factors, social factors, etc. There has been a lot of interest in the potential, first of all, for women's own production of estrogen during their younger years and up until menopause as contributing to the lower rates of heart disease that we were talking about in the beginning. And then with the onset of menopause and the halting of production of a woman's individual, her own estrogen, is associated time-wise with this increased risk of heart disease. That observation has then spawned an enormous amount of interest in whether one can give estrogen back to a postmenopausal woman as a medication to sort of restore the premenopausal production that may have occurred from her own estrogen production. And I will say that the clinical studies that have looked at that in the last several years have produced a lot of controversy and a lot of confusion for the following reason. And to summarize a very complicated thing very quickly, there were a whole series of initial studies where you just follow women as they're treated in everyday life. And those studies showed that women who happened to be treated with hormones postmenopausally had a significant reduction in their risk of heart disease.
Let me ask you to hold that thought, because we have to go to a break. It's going to be a long explanation, and I want to give you time to explain it. Because estrogen and heart disease is one of the hardest things we tackle on this program all the time because of the new information coming out, some of it contradictory. So stay with us. We'll be right back and talk more about women's health issues after this break. Don't go away. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about women's health issues. My guest, Sherry Martz of the Women's Health Research Society for Women's Health Research in Washington, Judy Auerbach of the American Foundation for AIDS Research, and Dr. Richard Karas, mouth's not working today, Associate Professor of Medicine at Tufts University School of Medicine in Boston. Our number, 1-800-989-8255, and as I normally do, severely and interrupted Dr. Karas when he was giving us an interesting answer to the connection between estrogen and heart disease. If you'd like to pick that up or start over, if you'd like,
sure.
Dr. Karas.
No, that's fine. I was just saying that we had a whole series of studies initially that suggested that women who took hormone replacement therapy postmenopause had a reduction in heart disease. Mm-hmm. More recently, as you've talked about on this show, the randomized trials, which are really considered the gold standard in clinical medicine, in a population of older women, did not show any benefit of estrogen on heart disease. And in fact, in some groups, there appeared to be an increase in heart disease with estrogen use. And that has really caused a lot of controversy and confusion in the field.
Mm-hmm. 1-800-989-8255, in case you're getting ready to ask a question. Have we resolved that controversy? Is there some?
I don't think it's fair to say we've resolved it, but I think with time and consideration, there are some ideas, important ideas, that are coming forward about what those differences might be. Mm-hmm. And very briefly, one of the areas that people are focused on is that these more recent studies started women on hormone therapy when they're in their mid to late 60s. And the common clinical practice is for women to start taking hormone therapy around the time of menopause, which would be around the time of 50, 51 years old. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of interest in the idea that this delayed initiation of therapy may have allowed the window to close during which there can be benefit from the hormones.
Mm. 1-800-989-8255. Let's go to the phones. Rebecca in Portland, Oregon. Hi, Rebecca.
Hi. Yeah, I just had a question. I lost a very dear friend and neighbor of mine a year and a half ago to, I guess, heart disease is the answer. I mean, they never really gave us a satisfactory reason, but she was 42 years old, and she just slumped over one day, and that was that, and she was gone, and, you know, it was real surreal, the paddles and all that stuff. But the only thing they ever found wrong with her in the autopsy was that she had a mitral valve prolapse, which she knew she had. She was a nurse. Her husband was an echocardiologist. But they had no inkling that even she was healthy, she was thin, she was active. How should she have known that she had any kind of problem?
Dr. Karras, let's try to broaden that out, because I know we don't ask you to diagnose individual cases here. We know it's not ethical to do that, so we don't like to put them in a position. But women, you mentioned a little bit of this, that women are not as cognizant of their own symptoms, especially with heart disease, because they sort of think they're immune from it for a long time.
Yeah, that's right. A couple comments. First of all, I'm sorry for the loss of your friend, obviously. Second, I think the really important point this brings up is actually for both men and women that about half the people who die from heart disease die right off the bat, no warning. And that's a very, very important reason for all individuals to be aware of, common preventive measures to reduce their risk of having heart disease, because you don't always get a warning to let you know that that's a problem.
May I jump in for just
sure.
a second, even though I'm not a heart disease specialist? This is Judy Auerbach talking about HIV. One of the things I think we have in common, again, across these disease areas and questions about sex and gender differences, is the lack of information is probably greater in some cases among women than men, or girls than boys, or certainly a perception by themselves that they're at risk for certain diseases or disorders, or by their healthcare providers. So I think historically, and Richard can correct me if I'm wrong, there's been a general sense that healthcare practitioners have not been as quick to assume heart disease among women, probably in part because it's more known among men, but also the research has primarily been among men until recently. And same is true of HIV and AIDS, where the epidemic early on got labeled as something, certainly in the United States, that affects chiefly men and chiefly gay men. Mm-hmm. So women aren't quick themselves to think that they're at risk, nor are the people who take care of them and look for symptoms and evidence.
Yeah, I agree with that. It's a very important point. And Sherry mentioned this very early on, the work of Dr. Lori Mosca and her colleagues, who published a survey earlier about a year ago showing that, or earlier this year, I mean, showing exactly that first of all, physicians are relatively poor at assessing an individual woman's risk of heart disease. And because of that underassessment of her risk, they undertreat. And I think that is indeed contributing to our lack of progress in reducing this disease in women.
Okay, Rebecca, thanks for calling.
Thank you.
This is Sherry. I'd like to chime in on that as well. But I think, you know, two points that your caller made. One, she was 42 years old, and two, she was thin and fit. And I think that again, the assessment of individual risk in women is sometimes colored by the fact that physicians think, well, as long as you're premenopausal, you're not at risk, that only women who are postmenopausal are at risk. And I think the youngest heart attack survivor I've met so far was 32 when she had her heart attack, and she was training for a marathon. So I think some of these misconceptions that we have because of the statistical facts that get reported make it a challenge for both women and their healthcare providers to adequately assess risk.
Dr. Martz, let me move on, because there's so much to talk about and so little time. Let's talk about clinical trials. I think is this really true that until relatively recently women were excluded from clinical trials?
Well, it wasn't true that women were excluded from clinical trials. However, the Food and Drug Administration, which regulates the marketing of drugs in the United States, in 1977 established a guideline that said that you could not put women of childbearing potential into a clinical trial for a new drug, mm-hmm. unless the drug was for a life-threatening disease for which there was no other therapy. So there were some studies, if it was a study that didn't involve giving a drug, women could be included, or if it, as I mentioned, if it were a study of a life-threatening disease for which there was no other treatment, women could be included. However, what this guideline had, the effect this guideline had was, it was just simpler to not put women into studies than mm-hmm. to try to argue whether or not they should be in the study. And that guideline led to really a lack of information about the response of women to therapeutic interventions, whether it was drugs, devices, preventive strategies, all that sort of thing. And you know, another good example coming out of the cardiovascular field was when the lipid-lowering drugs, when the statins first came on the market and the American College of Cardiology issued their guidelines for how to use them, the guidelines actually stated, we can't tell you how to use these drugs in women because there weren't any women in the studies. We don't have any data on how these drugs work in women. So it was a point of frustration, and it was the point that our organization got organized around. A group of physicians and researchers and activists said, this has got to change. That started in 1990, and by 1993, the FDA had completely reversed its guideline. They now say that you must include women in your clinical trials unless you have a scientific reason not to. Mm-hmm. So we have changed that. We are seeing studies including women more and more. What we're looking for now are answers to questions like, does this drug work in women the way it works in men? Is there a difference between the way the drug works in women and men? Is it in fact effective in one or more effective in one sex or the other? And so that's really where the research is heading now, and we'd like to see it heading there faster and in greater volume.
I'm trying to find the differences between men and women, how drugs work.
Yeah, and really looking at that question, you know, not making the assumption that just because it works in men, it works in women, or vice versa. There are actually a few drugs that have been put on the market that seem to work better in women than in men. And so, you know, we think that this is obviously important for patients. It's obviously important for healthcare providers to have this information. And it's a way of, you know, effectively heading towards this whole concept of individualized medicine. You know, if you're going to start treating an individual, what's the first thing you can look at? The first biological difference you can distinguish, well, are they male or female?
Yeah, Dr. Auerbach, does this also pertain to HIV/AIDS drug treatments?
Yes, certainly. And again, if we think just about the United States, where most of the clinical research has gone on and went on from the early time of the epidemic here, women were not as well represented amongst those who were infected, or at least for whom infection was detected. And so you had a very small number of women either available to be in clinical trials or who were recruited for clinical trials. So we've gone through this same discussion as Sherry was describing for the FDA. It's also occurred for the NIH, the National Institutes of Health, where we have seen a significant need for greater inclusion of women in clinical trials so that you can ask the question. I don't think any of us would presume there are sex differences, but we want to at least know because we have enough evidence from many areas of health that there are, and we can't make assumptions that the same drug or the same drug in the same quantity would be effective in the same ways for everyone. And we have seen that in HIV and AIDS, as I mentioned earlier.
Mm-hmm. Michelle in Naples, Florida. Hi, welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. This question is for Dr. Auerbach. You were alluding earlier to the dichotomy between biological differences and gender differences, or more aptly, the societal construction of gender, and how that has influenced the study of HIV and AIDS in women, and how the epidemic has more prominently been shown to affect women. And I was wondering if you could spell that out a little bit more for some of the listeners who may not know exactly what you're talking about. And I'll take my answer off the air.
Okay, thanks for calling.
Thanks. I very much appreciate the question because I realized that I didn't quite get the chance to elaborate on that. What I'm trying to say is that you have to look at the interaction of the biological, the physiological, and the social and cultural, and the way that gender is organized and operates in society. And to make that very concrete, probably the most important factor affecting vulnerability and some of this increased disproportionate impact on women and girls of HIV is poverty or economic inequalities. That's a social phenomenon. That's about how women and men have very different status in most societies with respect to economic or material resources. So women, generally speaking, and this is a generalization, in most places, particularly in poor countries, have been rendered for various social and cultural reasons more dependent on men for their economic livelihood. And some of that's codified in law, some of it's just custom, but generally speaking, this inequality is fairly universal between women and men. Well, what that means in the context of HIV and AIDS is that for a number of women, the only way that they can survive in many circumstances is to sell themselves as sex workers or people who engage in transactional sex of some sort. So they use sex as a commodity in exchange for money or for drugs in some situations, even for school fees. We find a number of young women in countries where the rates of infection among young girls or young women are, three times higher or four times higher than for young men. A lot of this has to do with them having to engage in this transactional sex in order to have enough money to pay for their school fees, their books, other material goods, accommodations, whatever that may be required. So it's not a sort of simple behavioral choice that some people like to reduce it to. You have to look at these social circumstances that confer or make it more likely that risk of transmission will occur. So economic inequalities is probably the biggest one, and other things are related to it. Another one has to do with early marriage, which, of course, is related to economic situations as well. And we know that early marriage is a risk factor for HIV infection among a number of women and girls. In some countries, a majority of sexually active girls are married by the age of 15 to 19, and they're typically marrying men who are older than themselves. Those men have probably had more experience and more sexual experience and may be more likely to have HIV infection that they either don't know they have or they don't tell the young women they have. So here you've got young girls who are married at a young age for cultural reasons. They're monogamous, they are legally married, and they're at risk for HIV infection. Mm-hmm. So there are a number of factors like that, economic, educational, early marriage, property and inheritance rights that don't allow for women and girls to own their own property or to inherit, which make them then dependent on other relatives or impoverish them, that again might induce them to have to engage in transactional sex, which is a very risky thing when HIV is in the population.
We're talking about women's health issues this hour on Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News.
Could I mention one last factor?
Sure. Oh, I'm sorry. Yes,
that's okay. I could go on and I don't want to, but I think it's real important to mention violence because that's another very important social cultural factor, but it's also one for which we see physiological implications. So it's one of the factors that we know affects vulnerability to HIV infection from the biological, the physiological. So coercive sex or sex that's, painful, where there's abrasions that occur because it's forced, can make, portals of entry for HIV infection more easily, can make it more possible for transmission to occur, in addition to all the social and cultural aspects of violent sex and why that happens. So we've seen very high rates of infection in countries where there are very high rates of sexual violence, South Africa, for example, that has a really astounding rate of rape, or a place like Rwanda where there's significant rape in the context of war and conflict. Some of that's even related to ethnic cleansing, where there's a deliberate attempt to infect women of one cultural group with HIV infection so that they and their children who might be born will die. And we know something like of the 250,000 women who were raped during the Rwandan genocide, about 70% of the survivors are HIV positive. So these are just some of the very scary but real social, cultural, economic factors that exacerbate infection among women and explain some of these differential rates.
Dr. Martz, I have 30 seconds, not a long time to answer, but if there's one area of women's health that needs a lot more research, where would you point us to?
I think I think HIV/AIDS is probably a worldwide and infectious diseases in general worldwide is probably the biggest consideration, including things like parasitic infections. We don't really understand the difference between the sexes in terms of risk and resistance to infection and ways of treating it. I think certainly in the developed world, cardiovascular disease and the diseases that result from smoking are probably the biggest women's health issue that we have to worry about. Mm-hmm. And so I think we've really hit on the two biggest areas today.
We could go on, and we will, of course, come back to women's health issues, as we always do. I want to thank all my guests. Sherry Martz, Vice President for Scientific Affairs at the Society for Women's Health Research in Washington. Judy Auerbach, Vice President for Public Policy and Program Development at AMFAR. Dr. Richard Karas, Director of the Women's Heart Center and Co-Director of the Molecular Cardiology Research Center at Tufts New England Medical Center. Thank you all for taking time to talk with us today.
You're welcome.
Kevin,
you're welcome. Kevin Wade is our technical director. Our audio engineers are Matt Galick and Kevin Kaminsky in New York. Greg Smith composed our theme music, and we had help today from NPR librarians Kim Oleski and Alphonse Vinn. Surf over to our website at sciencefriday.com. You can leave us email there. You can also find Science Friday's Kids Connection, where we make a free teaching curricula that you can use in your classrooms. Just press on the teachers button on the left side of the page. Also, we podcast Science Friday, and you can listen on your Real Audio player or your Audible.com player. Take us with you and listen at your convenience. Have a great weekend. We'll see you next week. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.